the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of ExchangeWire's MadTech Podcast. I'm Mariam, editorial lead here at ExchangeWire, and today I'm delighted to be joined by two very special guests. First, we have George Danfield, who is CMO at Trapo. George, thanks so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, really excited to get some of your insights. Also joining us is ExchangeWire's very own CEO, Rachel Smith. Rachel, thanks so much for taking the time to be here.
Not at all. I love being invited on to my own podcast. I say that very cheekily. Obviously, it's not my podcast.
Kind of is, but yeah. Okay, so
it's ready the audience. It's the audience podcast.
Yes,
exactly.
Quite right, yeah. George.
So ready to dive into our first topic. We've got a lot of exciting things to talk about today. So first up on the agenda is some news from Marketing Brew, which is, why are some brands embracing fake out of home? So as AI continues to push creative boundaries, many brands are using the tech to create fake out of home imagery of impressive yet non-existent out of home campaigns that catch the attention and spread brand awareness. So I'm sure you guys have seen brands such as Maybelline and Gymbox have dabbled in the area, producing out of home content exclusively for online consumption. So, George, I want to go to you first here. This is really interesting stuff. What do you think about this? Do you think fake out-of-home is harmless or is it corner-cutting?
So I think that I need to do a disclosure here. I'm a huge fan of AI. I think that I've been using AI for almost every single aspect of the business in Trapo, and I've been a huge promoter, so I need to make this disclosure first of all. But coming back to the article, I think that it's another style of guerrilla marketing, right? Guerrilla marketing is something that is catching the attention, is something that is outside of the box. So this fake, let's call it fake campaigns, it's something that it's in a way also guerrilla marketing. I remember the first time that I was looking on that Tube video, I was actually looking on myself and I was like, oh, wow, that's a really amazing guerrilla marketing. And after this, I was looking a little bit and reading the comments and so on, and it realizes that it's this kind of like deep fake video. I think that is also mentioned in the article that big brands are actually testing the grounds before going into production, because the reality is budgets for marketing are, I would say, for different companies is getting smaller and smaller. It's definitely a corner cutting. It's a corner cutting from a perspective of how you create the impact, how you create that buzz around it. It's absolutely impossible to do it on that level, how this all of this AI is generating. So huge fan. And definitely, I like it when companies are embracing new technology and also creating that, I would say, that style of buzz around.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you say that, because when I first saw it as well, I thought, how did they do this? This eyelash
Exactly.
Rachel, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I feel like the I think it was the last quote in the article that you shared with us, Mariam, for this story that encapsulated how I feel about it, which was, if somebody experiences these advertising campaigns and walks away thinking, okay, this isn't real, but it would be really cool if it was real, I think that is how I feel about it, right? So you look at that Maybelline eyelash campaign and think, that is the coolest thing that I've seen for ages. It's kind of, It's quirky. You know, I live in London, so obviously the London campaign was brilliant. You know, it incorporates a part of like day-to-day life as a Londoner. It's kind of cute. It's sort of, there's just something that really captures your attention. And quite frankly, that's what advertising and marketing is designed to do, right? So I'd agree with George that, you know, it could be seen as another version of guerrilla marketing. And so I think whatever tactics help to elevate brands to do something clever and something, enjoyable for consumers to look at and interact with is good work. On the corner cutting point, I think that's really interesting, because my mind immediately went to more traditional forms of out-of-home advertising and whether those that run those, you know, those suppliers that run out-of-home technologies, whether they feel a sense of someone's, you know, edging in on my territory here and creating a good use case for not needing to actually advertise out of home, instead just generating a similar experience using AI. Of course, they're not comparable properties, like for like comparable properties, but might it make people view authentic out of home advertising opportunities through a different lens? It's just a question that you know came to my mind. But you know, I really enjoyed all of those campaigns. I think they're brilliant. And also it reminded me of, you know, of some, I guess they were marketing campaigns. It reminded me of marketing campaigns of years and years ago, before we had fantastic AI tools at our disposal, which when they went viral and when they went global just seemed like the coolest thing ever. I don't know, you guys are probably too young to remember this, but my mind goes back. You don't even know where I'm going with this, George. But I remember the giant. Do you remember the giant rubber ducky that appeared in the Thames?
I remember that.
And then it turned up in Sydney Harbour. I thought that was the coolest thing known to mankind, because I was in London and then I went back to Australia for a holiday and wandered down to Circular Quay and went, oh my God, the rubber ducky's made it all the way to Sydney.
It's like cross-global, that they've almost made it, you know, cross-global. It's recognisable across many countries. It's really cool.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, this is a modern way, clever way of doing something similar to that. And I love it. From a consumer's point of view, I love it. This is the fun part of advertising for customers and consumers, I think.
Just to add, if I may, two things here. I like when discussions are bouncing together. That's the way that I would say, but it's a great podcast. Mm-hmm. So let's make it one. Going on your direction, Rachel, I think that you can see it also from a perspective of the consumer that is creating a lot of conversation. And always when, for example, when we are talking about KPIs of a campaign, conversation is one of them. Like, so that viral, people are talking, people are discussing, you know, like in marketing, we say something that bad publicity is also good publicity, right? Yeah. Or no publicity is actually bad publicity, right? So I don't see any, of course, if you're looking on that posts and that articles or in that campaigns, you're going to see that some people are commenting like, oh my God, this is fake news and why is this coming? It's fine. The fact that it's that extra push of from the consumer that is actually taking the effort to comment, I honestly, personally, from a CMO perspective, I don't see any problem whatsoever. So that's point number one. And the point number two is, all in the end of the day, when we are talking about budgets, it's all the way about conversions, at least in the world of e-commerce or in the world of retail. If that campaign actually generated viral effect, I'm sure that some sort of a level of stickiness is remaining. So that stickiness is translated into people that are curious to say that, by the way, let me look on that website, let me go to that retail shop, let me go to that whatever is marketplace and so on, and I'm most probably going to buy. So yeah, kudos to the embracing the technology. And point number three is that I find it quite interesting that you're saying that the traditional media out of home advertising, the one that are actually creating the experience, offline experiences, I think that companies are starting to be threatened by all of this new AI technology. And I've been seeing that also humans and marketers are threatened by new technology. But what I'm also recommending to companies that I'm speaking and to agencies or individuals in different levels of the business is that if you don't adapt, you're not going to survive. So AI is all about adapting, because it's going to be, probably it's not going to be used as much now next year because the technology is still not there. But in the next 5 years, the technology is actually going to be there, and you're going to be obsolete if you're not going to use it, especially as a marketer.
Yeah. And you can imagine, though, as well, that it opens up the opportunity for out-of-home advertising to be better connected with some other forms of digital advertising. And brands could do some really cool activations that involve both, right? And that sort of unpack that whole idea of the fakeness of it, the idea, which is much more about sort of imagination and imagery. So imagine that Maybelline then also ran a tube campaign that somehow incorporated that, you know, viral campaign to say, you know, you thought it was real, feel, didn't you? It wasn't, but, you know, and just sort of drew people even further into the viral nature of it. Plenty of opportunities there. And I think that could be a good way of people thinking about adapting rather than just holding to those traditional forms. Just on the fake element there as well, it was discussed in the article, to what extent should brands be upfront about that? You know, should they be? I mean, you mentioned, George, that you could sort of, these were not quite the words that you used, but what I'd understood from what you'd said is that you could sort of test the sentiment for it before you actually launch a campaign like this.
Yeah.
To what extent do you think brands should disclose it upfront, or does that really just heavily depend on the creative that you're looking at and the message that you're trying to get across?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that goes a little bit on the part of the regulation. I consider this as a moment brands are not required. I think that it's a moral compass that a company should have. You know, like if you want to disclose it, you can disclose it. But let me put that, I'm going to throw back the question. If a company is going to disclose it, if that element of viral is going to still be, probably not. Because that, yeah.
Maybe, yeah. I don't know, right?
Because I don't know also.
Because I think it's got the effect, like if I think about the Gymbox campaign in London, which was an advert on the top of a bus that said something like, that was, you know, in theory viewed from somebody looking out the window. And it said something like, if you're looking at this, you'd be really great at our acrobatics class, or you'd really enjoy our acrobatics gymnastics class, or something like that. And it was flagged immediately as being fake. And then there was lots of debate about whether it was, you know, it contravened advertising guidelines or not. But it just meant loads of people looked at it, right? Loads of people found out, you know, it had an additional viral effect, and the exact effect that you just mentioned too, which is that, you know, I'm a keen gym goer and I don't go to Gymbox. It's a particular gym brand that doesn't necessarily appeal to me, but it made me think. I was like, oh, maybe I should consider Gymbox then, actually.
Exactly.
So, yeah. It's super interesting. Sorry, Mariam, you're trying to get a word in edgeways there.
it's all good. You guys kind of answered my next question here, which was, what are the, you know, do you think there's any, really quickly, do you think there's any regulation required? Because we've sort of touched on all the pros, but, you know, I'm sure there's going to be some people out there who are thinking, well, this needs to be regulated. What are your thoughts on that? Rachel, I'll go to you first here.
Yeah, I mean, look, I concur a bit with what George has already said there, that there definitely needs to be some thought about this from a moral perspective. And it's important to have regulatory guidelines that help to provide the guardrails for that morality judgment, right? So you can't be entering into false advertising, but the examples that we've looked at are not false advertising, right? No one is going to be in the market for a giant mascara wand that's the size of a tube train. No one's going to be in the market for a giant jar of that hot sauce that's big enough to sit on a cruise ship. So, right. You know, that's not false advertising, not in my mind anyway. So then it comes down to the morality of, as we were just discussing, do you disclose this up front? And, yeah, there's definitely a room for regulation. And also there's, you know, this has been a hotly discussed topic in so many areas of marketing and advertising over the last 6 months. What, and actually in general in our lives and society, how are we going to keep pace from a regulatory point of view with the development, continued development, use and application of AI tools? And we definitely need to find a way to do that, keep pace with the development of those tools. And this is another example of how those tools are used and applied and what needs to be regulated. Because I think there's a big difference between fake news and fake you know, content that's trying to appear as though it has been originally authored when it isn't, and creative, engaging, fun, tactical content would be my point.
Right. George, really quickly, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that the regulation is probably what I'm probably seeing in the next years, because not to repeat what Rachel was saying, I'm a little bit, how much I'm a fan of AI, I'm a little bit questioning the human, actual content that is created by humans, it's not generated by AI. So what I think that my perspective is going to be in the future is probably that social media platforms, they are going to put whatever watermark or tag or whatever this content is generated by AI. However, we are going to do it, because the AI is getting better and better and is actually more and more difficult to actually to see whatever is done with AI. I can give you a super funny example and super quick one. I remember that in one of my visuals from Trapo, we had like one guy that had a tattoo here, and I was asking the designer to remove it, and in 1 second he came back, and here it is. He was basically using Adobe Illustrator or Adobe Photoshop, and he was basically writing "remove tattoo." Is that AI or is that human touch? I don't know which one it is, because it's kind of like sitting in the both. So I think that we are a little bit in the early days of platforms to understand what is AI and what is not AI. And so you have that tag from the platform to see that it's that human effort that is put in that, whatever is that piece of video, CGI, video content, AI, music, et cetera, et cetera. But you have also that human component, that government component. I'm curious to see how governments are basically imposing some sort of a regulation.
Definitely. Really interesting stuff there. I feel like we could talk about AI for weeks, but I'm just going to move on. I'm just going to move on to our second news story of the day, which comes out of tech in Asia. And that is Taiwan shopping apps is due to reach 26.6 billion hours due to holidays. So time spent in shopping apps, is seen to reach 26.6 billion hours on Android devices in the fourth quarter of 2023. This is a 6% jump from the previous quarter, according to data from Data AI. Downloads are expected to increase by nearly 25% to 75.9 million monthly across November and December, 8 million per month more than the holiday season in 2022. So these are some huge numbers that we're talking about here. Rachel, how do you think the brands can make the most of this increased usage?
Well, it depends on what type of shopping apps we're talking about here. And given that the article is coming from Tech in Asia, I'm betting that some of this activity is relating to what we often refer to in the West as super utility apps, which are, you know, potentially becoming app-driven marketplaces that are enabling people to buy lots of different products and lots of different services within that one app. At least that's what I think a lot of these utility apps companies would like to, you know, that's a business model that they'd like to have adopted. And by that, I guess, you know, obviously the equivalent in Western economies are your Ubers and your Deliveroos, that you can now not just, you know, hail a ride, but you can also do some grocery shopping, and you can also get obviously your takeaway delivered, but you might also be able to get some other goods and services. And I know that in some markets within Southeast Asia, those apps are becoming really sophisticated. So I'm imagining that maybe some of these, yeah, exactly. So I'm really keen to hear your point of view on this, George, and what your experience is based living there. So I'm imagining, you know, that some of these numbers are associated with that. So opportunity for advertisers in that marketplace, I think, is huge. And what we're talking about now then is, we mentioned this a lot at ATS Singapore on stage a couple of weeks ago, we're talking about the proliferation of these sort of walled garden environments, discrete buying environments, where there will be advertising and marketing opportunities within a Grab ecosystem or marketplace, within a Gojek ecosystem or marketplace. And, you know, those are the two sort of super utility apps that spring to mind across, you know, countries like Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, and probably elsewhere in Southeast Asia. If another point sort of just on the general flock to in-app shopping, which I think is proliferating globally as well, not just in Asia, as this article suggests. I just think that everything to do with shopping in a mobile environment, your mobile devices, the way that apps operate, people's tolerance for shopping and shopping in app have just accelerated hugely in the last couple of years. So even if I row back, a really basic example, even if I row back to when I bought the house that I'm currently living in 4 years ago, I bought quite a lot of furniture online. I definitely didn't buy really any of it through apps. I probably bought it, I did use my mobile device for a lot of it. And people thought that was really weird. Like people were like, what? Like you bought a fridge on your mobile? You bought it. And I mean, that sounds ridiculous, right? It's only 4 years ago, or maybe it's coming up to five. It's like four and a half now. It's not that long ago. And people
That's
still
how quickly
were,
things change.
Exactly. People were still quite reluctant to make those big purchases. And think about all the online furniture stores that here in the UK have since gone bust. I'm thinking of places like made.com and stuff, because that is a really difficult business model, that one. furniture online. But you know, people these days would think nothing of buying a sofa or an armchair or a large purchase that they haven't seen in person that they are now willing to spend a lot of money on and get it delivered directly. And you do it for the convenience because there's also often no other option. You can't go and see those things in person anymore, often in big cities like London, because you don't have furniture showrooms conveniently located, blah, blah. But the point here is that, and those are not necessarily app examples, but you can see now how those brands have moved into a completely different world where they're like, okay, we've got a serious customer base here. We could drive them to an app and then we could create a completely different customer experience in that app environment. Obviously, opportunities for marketing and advertising is completely different in that context because you're talking about maybe brands trying to reach mobile users outside of an app environment, which we know is virtually, you know, is very difficult given privacy setups across both iOS and Android. So that's sort of different. But I suppose I raised that point just to say, I can understand why people are doing loads more in-app shopping, and I think the opportunities are becoming vast, and parts of the world like Asia are leading the way.
So, George, as our resident APAC expert and also just general resident living in APAC, what are your thoughts on that? You know, how do you think brands can make the most of this increased usage?
One of my favorite topics, because this marketplaces, and let's call them the super shopping ads, I even don't know how to call it, because the life in Southeast Asia, so just for the disclosure, I'm kind of like based in all of these four countries, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, and Thailand. I'm kind of like nomading among all of them, mostly based in Indonesia. The reality is that shopping ads are absolutely huge. So when we are talking about shopping apps in Southeast Asia, the biggest players in the industry is Shopee and Lazada. That's the equivalent of probably Amazon. But TikTok, with their TikTok shopping, is gaining huge increase of visibility and awareness and usage from a perspective of competing with, it's so funny now to say, traditional shopping apps, which are Shopee and Lazada. To give an example how big it is, Shopee, for example, which is actually, I think, the biggest, I was reading some statistics in 2022, so only 2022, they generated in Southeast Asia $7.3 billion with an increase of 42.3% from the previous year.
Wow.
Now I think they're even huge. To give another statistic, 11.11, which is the single days, I was reading that in China, for example, and Southeast Asia is actually coming super close, combining Southeast Asia, right? It's kind of like four times bigger than Black Friday in America. Mm. So just for your audience to understand the impact of these networks. The reality is that all of these networks are basically, you have for small, medium enterprises and for startups and for single creators that they want to sell something online, it's a completely new audience. It's a completely new market that it was a void that traditional shopping, like it was impossible to void. Because what's happening at the moment, you are doing, for example, live, for example, it's shopping live. It's huge. I can give you an example. There are companies that are doing lives 24 hours per day, nonstop, 6 or 10 hosts continuously for one simple brand. The phenomenal in Southeast Asia, when we're talking about the experience of the shopping, it's completely uncomparable with what is happening in Europe or in US from the perspective of not only the behavior with all of this live, but also from a perspective of innovation from a perspective how actually all of these brands like Shopee, Lazada, TikTok with their marketplace is actually pushing the consumers to buy more through all of the incentives, coins, discounts, initial discounts for new users, cashback. And the fair reality is that the all of this GDPR and certain level of trackability doesn't exist. I mean, like, we need to face it that trackability is not in Southeast Asia, right? So regulations are a little bit more loose. That's, I'm sorry to say this, but less regulation is actually sparkling innovation. I don't know if both of you agree or not, but this is some for a European that is living in Southeast Asia, comparing it with even with the Uber, comparing with Bolt or every other shopping apps, it's nowhere comparable, because the amount of people that are buying and the amount of new features that are releasing on these apps, it's absolutely impossible to compare.
I mean, there's so many interesting things in those statistics that you've shared there, George, and just also your opinions, because it really highlights the differences between these global regions, right? Like, the other thing about Asia, and particularly Southeast Asia, is you're talking about a really quite young demographic in comparison to European marketplaces and US marketplaces. So really high proportion of younger consumers. I don't mean teenagers, I mean young, yep, becoming sort of middle class, consumers that have got some money in their pockets. Huge levels of mobile penetration. It's been like that for a long time. So any of the innovations that are coming to things like live shopping and shopping in a mobile environment, I think, are definitely coming from that region. So they're being developed there, and you're quite right, quite possibly because there's less restriction, less regulation, less concern about the value exchange between data and shopping incentives. And so all of that makes for an entirely different marketplace. And it's super interesting because live commerce and live shopping, we've been following for quite a while, or at least for the last couple of years, to see how it's unfolding in Asia. And it is just not, I mean, you're 100% right, it's just not tracking to the same extent in the US and Europe. It's just not picking up in the same way at all. And I'm really interested to understand why. The other thing is, because we'll come on to this in our next story, right? So many interesting things about Indonesia, TikTok, and, you know, everything that's unfolded there. But the other thing that I think about this is, so for brands and marketers that are looking to advertise to consumers in those marketplaces, where are those budgets coming from? Are those retail media budgets, or are those budgets that would have been dedicated towards other shopping style activity, or are they fresh budgets? Are they brand new budgets?
Interesting question. I think that it's a little bit of both, to be honest. I can tell you, I don't know how it's happening in other companies, but I can tell you how it's happening in Trapo, for example. We actually allocated it from the marketing budget initially in order to create, to sponsor advertising, because you still need to advertise on these platforms. Yep. Working similar with Meta ads or Google ads. It's still coming from the marketing budget from a perspective of hiring all of this live host. And it's still coming from the marketing budget from a perspective of creating all of this content, because in the end of the day, you're creating a UGC content, or you're creating an unpolished piece of content, but you're tagging it with your actual product and you're connecting it to your marketplace, and that level of visibility needs to happen. But I see that I'm contradicting a little bit myself now, but I'm seeing also that some other companies are experiencing it from creating a completely different department that is actually only focusing on live commerce. And I was mentioning before that they are doing live 24/7, 7 days per week, 6, 10, 15 hosts. They are allocated budget to create an entire floor only for live people that are only talking. And I definitely recommend the audience to search online. I'm sure that there is some sort of video to see that level of convincing. I'm actually comparing it a little bit with what it used to be in the days with telemarketing.
Live TV shopping channels. Yeah,
exactly. But they're more aggressive than this. They're even more aggressive, because you can actually see at the moment that people are commenting. And for example, we did a live 2 days ago on Shopee, and we reached 5,000 people that they were looking simultaneously from 10 to 12 a.m. Who's in which market in Europe, for example, people are staying from 10 to 12 a.m.? So, exactly.
But I mean, then that also comes down to the type of products here, where we're diving off into all sorts of directions. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, George, and we'll go into this in the second part of the podcast when you tell us a bit more about what you're doing at Trapo, but it's car accessories, auto.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm imagining the type of content that you're producing in that live commerce, live shopping environment could be engaging in a completely different way to the average piece of UGC content. And that's what people are tuning into, right? So it's not just, I want to see what Trapo are doing because I definitely need to buy an X for my car. It could be, oh, this is interesting because I'm generally interested in cars. And, oh, this is actually quite an engaging piece of content, right? So it's happening not just, you know, from the point of view of pushing and promoting a specific product, but also creating some attention-grabbing content in an environment where people are actually spending more time, right? So it's sort of touching a number of different bases.
But I think that we need to touch base what actually is doing for the brands, for the companies I'm talking here. Unfortunately, all of these marketplaces, let's call it marketplaces because that's the kind of like the terminology that it's used here in Southeast Asia. We can call it marketplaces or shopping platforms. It's actually creating a threat for the brand.com websites. Because the problem is, there are actually multiple problems. One of them is that you don't own the data. You don't own, besides the name, address, and the phone number, you don't have email, or you cannot do remarketing for all of your consumers that are coming from the marketplaces. So that's a huge problem. Second of all, what we are seeing with all of these marketplaces is that because they are so aggressive in competing with each other, Shopee is competing with Lazada, and Shopee and Lazada is competing with TikTok, or TikTok is competing with the other them with Shopee and Lazada, they are giving a lot of incentives to the consumers. So they are subsidizing actually discounts. So let's say that my product costs $100 for the sake of the example. My product costs $100. What if it's $100 on the mybrand.com website? It's actually $90 or $80 or $70 on Shopee or Lazada or TikTok, because that difference of $10 or $10 or $30, whatever is that difference, is actually not coming from me as a brand, but it's coming from the platform itself. So any type of the consumers, while you're asking it, is going to say that I prefer, rather than go to the brand.com, I prefer to go to the marketplace. But the problem is that I don't control the data, and it's creating an unfair competition with the brand.com. And the third problem is that all of these platforms are increasing actually the commission. So if initially it was, for example, let's say a 2% commission or a 3% commission, now I've been seeing fast forward three years later, which is a small, I would say, time frame, it can go up to 10 or 15% from 2%. Wherever on my brand.com, my commission depends on the payment gateway is probably still remaining at about 2%. So there is also a downside, or the other side. We are looking from a perspective of a consumer, but let's look also from a perspective of the brand itself.
Absolutely. And I'd be really interested to know how you're trying to tackle that at Trapo, right? Because presumably you want that data, you want email addresses, you want the ability to be able to revisit those customers, sell them new things, etc. But then I guess you're hoping for compensation by volume. Yeah, exactly. And you're getting perhaps a higher volume opportunity within those marketplaces.
Yeah, there are certain ways that you can we say something that as follow: if there is a loyal customer, you basically go to the website. So let's speak a little bit about the buyer persona or the ideal customer. If it's a loyal customer, it usually goes to the website, because I have, for example, a loyalty program, which is creating kind of like an incentive.
Yeah.
If it's, for example, a person that is looking more, or a customer that is looking a little bit more for the discounts, for sure is going to go for marketplaces. And it's, unfortunately, it's a little bit difficult, because the more you buy on the marketplaces, not necessarily from me as a brand, but from all of the other small players or other companies, you're receiving all of these coins, and it's basically stacking, and you buy from Trapone on discounted price, what I basically mentioned before. So loyalty program is one of the solution. The other solution, which is a little bit more sneaky, but you know, like, we are creative, we need to find a way. One thing that we've been doing is, because we are not allowing actually to drive traffic to the brand.com, we actually create we call it a e-warranty form. So you're buying from the marketplace, but in order for you to say that, okay, I want you, in order to buy that product, you need to have a warranty, but you need to scan this QR code, which is leading the consumer to the brand.com. You fill a form, and after this, I'm putting you to all of my funnels, email, whatever it is. So there are ways to find it. And probably another way, I was actually talking with another brand. Depends what you want to, what you said, Rachel, you want to follow the volume, or you want to follow, for example, your consumers. I see some brands that are saying that certain products are available on the marketplace, certain products are only available exclusive on the website, or even lower price on the brand.com website. And with all of the coins and cashback and so on, it's kind of like not even matching. So, but that one is super difficult. And I think that you're, as a brand, you're shooting yourself in the foot. I think that I would say that probably the suggestion is loyalty program, whatever e-warranty or whatever is working, and probably exclusive products on the yourbrand.com.
Super interesting. I've got so many more questions, but I won't take up time, Marion. You'll be keen to jump in here.
So I'm keen to jump into our last sort of news topic of the day, which, staying on brand awareness and that sort of thread, news that's just come out of Financial Times is that TikTok shops around for options in wake of Indonesia app ban. So in the wake of TikTok shop being shut down in Indonesia, ByteDance is apparently exploring how to save its e-commerce business in the country. Options such as building a new app or partnerships with local companies are being considered as the Chinese-owned group looks to maintain a presence in its biggest marketplace. One suggestion has been to create an online commerce platform that would be separate to its video app in a bid to satisfy regulators in the Southeast Asian economy, according to three people with knowledge of the matter. So, Rachel, going to you first here, how can TikTok retain their presence in Indonesia?
So, it's super interesting. George is going to be the expert on this, but I thought that this story was, because we've known about this for quite some time, right? I thought this story was an interesting collision between the sort of the popularity of live shopper commerce that we've just been talking about in that previous story in Asia compared with Western economies, and the sort of data privacy and data ownership concerns that are associated with ByteDance being a Chinese company, right? And how ByteDance are facing that throughout the world, because I don't, you know, there's been lots of talk of TikTok being banned in other regions, either TikTok, the outright, you know, video platform. I find what's also really interesting about this story is the trajectory of TikTok Shop. Is that what it's called?
TikTok Shop.
Yeah. And you just mentioned it earlier on as well, George, that it's huge and it's growing really rapidly. I mean, Indonesia, I believe, was one of the first markets that they launched it in anyway. So, perhaps it's not surprising that it's built up to the extent that it has. But this sort of provides TikTok, I think, with a genuine dilemma. And the article in the FT was really interesting because, you know, some of the suggested strategic options for TikTok were to just forget about Indonesia altogether, because they won't be able to win either way. And instead, they should just go and try to dominate over in the US. But my feeling on that is I think they're going to face very similar headwinds in the US. It's not going to be straightforward, right? Because this is a two-pronged issue. It is about the rise in popularity of marketplaces. Let's adopt George's language here because I think it's a good way to describe these platforms. So the rise in popularity in marketplaces and what everyone's doing in them, whether there is fair competition within those marketplaces. And, you know, again, the FT article talked about the issues that TikTok were facing with the Indonesian government concerning, fair competition. And George, you raised, I think, an issue that I think will start growing, which is from a marketer's point of view, what happens to the data? I don't always get it back. You know, you collect this data from customers that buy my product and I don't get that shared with me. And also, what's fair commission and what's a fair trajectory in terms of the increase in commission? So all of those issues, I think it's still going to be rolling around, not just for TikTok, but in other shopping platforms or other marketplaces as well. And general suspicion of the Chinese government. I don't see that going away anytime soon. So, you know, I think it's a collision of these things. And it's really interesting that it's all kicked off in Indonesia before it got super serious in the US. I sort of thought it would go the other way around. They're my summary thoughts.
Right, George, you know, as someone who's based a lot out of Indonesia, as you mentioned, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think, you know, what are some ways that you think TikTok can retain their presence in Indonesia? And do you think that, you know, this growth of social commerce is going to cause more regulatory headaches? Or, yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Such interesting. We're picking all of the interesting topics, but I'm a huge fan of it, including TikTok. I need to make a statement before I jump into your question, Miriam. I'm probably going to be a little bit controversial here. And I'm going to say that I don't believe in privacy nowadays.
That's very
controversial. And the reason why I say that I don't believe in privacy is that I'm having a phone that is actually tracking. I'm having an iPhone that is tracking me 24/7. I'm having Facebook or Meta or how you want to call it on my phone. I'm having Instagram. I'm having Telegram. I'm having WhatsApp. I'm having TikTok. What's the difference on the TikTok? Here is a little bit. And believe me, I don't want to go into the political debate here because that's purely not my place to be, and I'm not an expert whatsoever. But because it's coming from China, that is why it's kind of like triggering all of this nonsense, and I'm going to put it very nonsense. Once again, I said from the beginning as a disclosure that I'm going to be controversial. Okay. I personally don't understand what's the big buzz about it. Probably it's because there is a Chinese company and it's that regulation and that privacy. But in the reality, all of these devices and apps are doing exactly the same thing what the Western apps are doing. I'm sorry to say this, but this is my personal opinion. I think that we need to be in a world that we should speak what we think, right? Now, this entire introduction closed, I think that Indonesia, living in Indonesia, the way that I see Indonesia from a perspective of regulation, probably, I don't know if it's the right word, it's a little bit very fluid from a perspective of regulation. It was a surprise, and I was actually surprised exactly how you said. I'm quite surprised because Indonesia has been talking for quite some time regarding banning TikTok markets or TikTok shopping. I consider it a little bit of a bold move that they actually did it. I remember that a few months ago or last year, there were some discussions regarding also some other apps like Facebook, Instagram, because they needed to face the regulation from a perspective of the data being kind of like, I don't remember exactly, but I think it was in that direction that they needed to disclose the information to the Indonesian government. And somehow they found a way not to happen, but they were actually, there were some discussions saying that they're going to be banned, but somehow they didn't. What I think that is going to happen, I don't think that personally this ban is going to stay, because it generated, in the article is mentioning, I think it was $6 billion they generated in terms of the revenue. Indonesia has 273 million people. That's probably one of the reasons that TikTok shopping started in Indonesia. Indonesia is the entire archipelago of Indonesia is wildly spread. The mobile penetration is only there, so that shopping experience is going to be a little bit different in all of these remote areas. Plus, there is another consideration regarding Indonesia. TikTok as a platform, as a shopping platform, is actually enabled all of the small manufacturing manufacturers to sell their goods to the entire archipelago of Indonesia, which was absolutely impossible before. So I need to, probably that discussion is going to go back from to the TikTok government. And I know that there is a lot of buzz going on the social media in Indonesia, because all of the small consumers are actually really upset because they lost the most important source of revenue. Mm-hmm. Coming back to what I said, I don't think that is actually going to stay. And I don't think that is going to be actually the case of TikTok opening a different platform, because that's going to trigger a ripple effect to other countries. You mentioned that, Rachel, that they want to, for example, to open, for example, US. If that's going to be the case, that ripple effect is going to be not only in US, but it's going to be also in, because there are some voices in Malaysia and in Thailand, which is also really huge TikTok shopping. I think that it's a little bit too early to say, because it happened super recent. Or they're going to, I personally don't think that they're going to open a new app. If that regulation is going to stay in place, probably they're going to abandon Indonesia. Doubt it. But from a perspective, coming back to our previous discussion, consumers, they still have a way to sell, or small companies, they still have a way to sell different goods. For example, Live is another one, but you don't actually can click on it and say, okay, it goes directly to the market. Yeah, it's basically based on voice and saying that, hey, by the way, go to our website, which now, for example, in Malaysia, if I would do that, it's automatically the bot is triggering and it's blocking my life. So yeah, that's quite interesting.
First question, back to you, George, is, and excuse my ignorance on this topic, is there any way that there is any Indonesian-owned platform that could become a credible rival to TikTok Shop? It might not be, you know, at the same stage of development as TikTok is, but, you know, could the likes of the Tokopedias or any of those guys scale up faster? I mean, I don't know enough about these platforms to know. And the reason I ask is because I think that point about making it possible for all of those small shop owners and those small merchants and small stores to be able to sell to the entire Indonesian archipelago, I think that is incredibly important point, and it's super powerful, right? And because you've presented it, and I can understand why this would absolutely be the case, as one of the most compelling arguments to get the government to come back to the table and try to negotiate with TikTok on this, because it's such a big deal. So it just strikes me, is there not a local incumbent that could be looking to get in on the marketplace there, and the government could be looking to try to support them to do that?
So I think that whereas the uniqueness of TikTok is because they basically started as a social media platform, and after this they kind of like grew on this marketplace, on this shopping experience. The other ones you mentioned, Tokopedia, and there are a couple of more in this Blibli.com and Shopee and Lazada, which are basically the entire region. But you have, for example, also Gojek. Mm. Gojek is, I would say, the Uber on steroids, because you can basically do absolutely everything. You can do delivery, you can do shopping, they have a marketplace, you can do payment getaways, etc., etc. So there is no, to answer your question, there is no app or a super app that is actually filling that both of the voids, which is a social media platform and a marketplace platform. All of this Tokopedia is there only because that's basically what is saying the regulation. Or you're a social media platform, or you're a marketplace, right? So there is no void that is coming on both of them. Mm. As a small startup or a small individual that is selling, for example, sambal, which is called, it means spicy in English, they still can sell on Tokopedia, they can still sell on Shopee. Lazada is a little bit more tricky because it's more favoring brands as actual brands like Nike, Adidas, and so on. But you don't have that stickiness of social media. So I think that's, once again, because you're basically posting a video, is creating that viral effect, and you're basically tagging your product. If it's so easy now on TikTok to go to 1 million views, and you're basically tagging the product, and after this, we're going to the marketplace. So that void is impossible to fill.
Yeah, so interesting. I won't say much more because I know time's ticking away and Mariam will be keen to move us on to the last part of the podcast. But the one thing, again, I'd have a million more questions, but we'll have to have another conversation at a later date to cover all of those. But the one thing I would say just on your points of, and your full disclosure on your personal opinions on privacy, I completely concur with you that in in reality, there is no difference between a Chinese-owned platform doing what they will with your data and Meta doing what they will with your data, as far as I'm concerned. What those individual governments might be more interested in is a whole other political debate.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I agree with you. This notion that somehow some other tech company can be the arbiter of privacy, such as Apple, such as Meta, such as Google, they're all shopping in the same, I didn't mean to use the word shopping, they're all fishing in the same pond, let's put it that way. So I do concur with that. And I think that adds a really interesting dimension to the privacy debate. But Mariam, I'll let you carry on.
Really interesting stuff there, guys. Thank you for your insights on that. Just bringing us to the last part of the podcast, which, George, I want to put the spotlight back on you a little bit and what you're doing at Trapo. So just a little bit conscious of time here, I'm going to sum up two questions into one. So what have you been up to? Are there any new sort of exciting developments that you'd like to highlight to the industry? And yeah, what are some ad trends that you're predicting and in the region?
Yeah, so just a super, super quick. Who is Trapo? What I'm doing? I'm the CMO of Trapo. Trapo is a company that is selling car accessories in Southeast Asia. We are present in Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, and Thailand. We are selling a wide range of products from car mats, which is basically our bread and butter because we're manufacturers. And we are selling, for example, dash cams, phone holders, et cetera, et cetera. Omnichannel business from a perspective online, offline. Online means brand.com, marketplaces, and also shopping. I think that's kind of like the unique sauce of us because we created the omnichannel presence where there was no omnichannel presence. For example, for a product that we initially started as the car mat, we were among the first that we created the brand on a product that people didn't care so much or they didn't kind of like considering before that. And we kind of like created the unique approach. In terms of what is interesting next year is definitely, I think that everything that we've been discussing, it's the marketplace's growth and how the brands are basically going to compete with the in-house, it's an internal competition or how it's going to compete with all of these marketplaces. That's an interesting approach. It's going to be the increased spend on live because it's still the number one drive when it comes to all, because you can do a live not only on TikTok, but you can do also a live on Shopee, Lazada, and so on, and all of these the other marketplaces. So that's going to be an interesting topic. And another quite interesting development, we've been seeing that all of these marketplaces are actually increasing, but we've been seeing also for certain verticals in the business, in the industry, people, they kind of like got a little bit more fed up with online shopping. I'm not talking about the majority, but they are more eager to actually walk into a retail store. So pandemic or post-pandemic, it's actually the trend is on the retail is actually starting to get up and going up. So there are a lot of happenings. I see a lot of traffic, walkthroughs in all of these shopping malls across Southeast Asia. I see a lot of events from, we call it roadshows, different roadshows on automotive, fashion, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a lot of happening on the offline marketing from that perspective.
Such a big part of, no, I think that's like a really good whistle stop tour. But that's that last point on sort of shopping malls and stuff, that's such an integrated part of life in Southeast Asian cities, right? Like the shopping mall is a big thing. It's where there's food and other entertainment opportunities and people go there at all times of the day or night, and there are lots of family opportunities there as well, games and things for kids and entertainment. And I'm not surprised to hear you say that, because even the little, I visit Asia a lot, and the time I've spent in places like Singapore is fairly significant, other Southeast Asian countries less so. But even when I am in places, other Southeast Asian countries, I'm always interested to see how much of a part of the social life that entire environment is.
Yeah, malls are basically where the life is happening. Is the gathering point. I mean, the moment in KL and on a radius of probably like 10 kilometers, there are probably like five shopping malls. It's huge. And Singapore is the same. Jakarta is the same. Bangkok is the same. I mean, like, they're absolutely huge and is a gathering point, a meeting point. You can eat, you can do entertainment, you can do shopping, you can eat, you can do absolutely everything in that proximities. Plus, it's so hot outside and it's the only place that you can have AC.
Climate controlled. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
You're not going to get caught in a thunderstorm, in a tropical storm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, guys, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today's episode. George, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. It's been really, really insightful.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you so much for the invitation. I think that it was a super interesting discussion. I hope that we can have another one very soon.
Definitely. Rachel, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Always enjoyable to be on the podcast, and it was great to have that chat with George.
And that was it for this week's MadTech podcast.